Hi everybody, how are you? In 2003, there was a wonderful historical novel that hit the scenes to immediate critical praise. It was called Maisie Dobbs. And it was immediately nominated for just about every award under the sun that's available to mystery writers and literary writers. It was nominated for Best Novel for Edgar. It won the Agatha for Best Novel. It was quickly followed in 2004 by Birds of a Feather, which was the sequel, which again was followed by another one in 2005, Carnival Lies. And then last year we had Messenger of Truth. Every single one of Jacqueline's books has been nominated for an Agatha, including this one, although we didn't put that in the announcement when we scheduled this because the Agatha nominees hadn't come out. So without further ado, please allow me to introduce one of our stellar members, Jacqueline. Now, Maisie Dobbs, as those of you who have read it are aware, and those of you who have not may want to learn, First of all, it's Patty Sonia. It's for sale in the back, and Bobby will be there later, so you can get it, and Jackie will be available to sign it. I think of that book essentially as being a fictional biography, because it's one of the truly character-driven pieces in our genre. And when people sometimes ask me what the difference between a plot-driven story and a character-driven story is, the example I give them of a character-driven story is Maisie Dobbs. Now, one of the things about Maisie is that we learn just about everything there is to know about this woman, beginning with her childhood in South London, how she's adopted by a member of the gentry, and or not legally adopted, but taken under the wing thereof, sent to public school, how she comes under the wing of an extraordinary man who teaches her much about the meaning of life, then becomes a nurse during World War I, tragically falls in love, and as a consequence of the scarring experiences, all of the Maisie Dobbs books, by the way, are deeply informed with the tragedy of the Great War, World War I, becomes an extraordinary detective. All of this combined with an absolutely wonderful whodunit that it is one of the most eminently satisfying books I've read in the last 10 years. Now, if you take a look at Maisie, we know so much about her, and then if you take a look at Jacqueline Winspear's website and go to her biography page, we learn a lot about her, too. She emigrated to the United States in 1990. And that's about it. So, at any rate, I did not come up with a whole bunch of deliberate questions for Jackie for this interview, which is normally what I do when I like to do an interview. But we have such a... I don't know where Jackie's going to lead us. And with a woman with her erudition and amazing knowledge, I wanted to go wherever she leads us. But there are some topics I want to talk about. The first one is your personal background, because this is something that obviously is
the FBI
not
know all about me, believe me.
One of the things that happens when somebody designs or starts to write about a particular protagonist is the truism is that this is a idealized or improved version of oneself, that you put a lot of yourself into a character. Now, I don't necessarily subscribe to that theory, but how much of Maisie is informed by your own experiences?
That's a really good question. I mean, first of all, I just repeat something one of my friends said to me after Maisie Dobbs was published, and she said, you know, it's really interesting. She said often when she taught a lot of writers. She does writing classes up in the Bay Area, and she said that with a lot of her students, she's seen their work published, and she can really see them as a character sort of reflected in their protagonist or what have you. And she said, but you know, you're nothing like Maisie Dobbs. the thing is that, you know, we have a cast of characters, and there is something of us in each of those characters, perhaps another way that we look at the world. One of the wonderful things about having different characters is that you can stand in those shoes and you can look through the lens that character looks at the world in. I mean, I actually, for example, I love the character of Priscilla, you know, and there's a certain devil in me that loves looking at the world through her eyes. Having said that, I think it was after, maybe it also was published, but I think more after Pardonable Lies. My very, very best friend ever has three kids. And after they all read that book, Anne-Marie, every time she did something, they said, oh, all right, Priscilla. But I think that there's something in each character that's another way that we look at the world.
For those of you who haven't read the books, Priscilla is Maisie's school days chum, who figures prominently in several of the stories. And Maisie is a very deliberate and introspective character. Priscilla is anything but. She's very ebullient and outgoing. And so the two of them are very much a force. How much in your background prepared you to be a writer?
I think actually quite a lot in my background prepared me to be a writer. I when I look back on my childhood, it was quite a solitary childhood in its way. My parents actually left London when they were first married. They were married quite young, I suppose, 22. And it was just after the Second World War. And, the part of London they lived in was decimated. It was bomb sites. And I don't know if any of you know anything about London after the Second World War, but, they always said that the peace was worse than the war. Rationing, the terrible deprivation, for example, that went on after the war. And they decided to move to the county of Kent. It was a few years before I came along, but they wanted to get as far away from that kind of environment as possible. So we lived in a very, very rural area in Kent. And, I spent a lot of time alone as a kid or surrounded by adults. But I decided that I wanted to be a writer when I was about 6 years old, purely for selfish reasons, actually. Can I tell you about that very quickly? When I was about 6 years old, maybe it was a bit before that, actually, it was discovered that I had a common childhood ailment, but worrying nonetheless, and that's the whole lazy eye thing, And by the time I was six, I had to go to the hospital every 2 weeks for exercises on my eyes, which was very exhausting, to prepare me for surgery when I was about six or seven. And we had to go on the bus, because we didn't have a car when I was a kid, so we had to go on the bus, this bone shaker bus, all through the little villages to get to Tunbridge Wells, which was where the main hospital was. And there was this one house just in a place called Pembury, which is just outside of Tunbridge Wells, if you're familiar with that area at all. And the bus stopped right outside this house, but normally if you were walking along the street, you would not have seen it. Because it had a very big hedge outside, but I was at the top of the bus and I used to stay awake so I could look into not just the house but one particular room. It was a big double-fronted Edwardian villa, and there was this one room with a big bay window, and it was a beautiful room except it was somewhat dark. Just, every wall had books, and there was a fireplace and a desk right in the bay with a black typewriter on it. And every week it seemed as though something was different. There was a book placed upside down on top of the typewriter. There was a cup and saucer there, a cardigan over the back of the chair, maybe an umbrella to the side, or maybe there was a fire in the grate, but I never saw the person. And one day I said to my mum, I always went up to the front top, but my mum couldn't stand heights, so she stayed at the bottom of the bus. And I made her come upstairs and I said, who do you think lives in that house? And she said, well, looking at that room, I would say a writer lives there. And I said, that's it, I'm going to be a writer. I just wanted the room. It was in my head. It took me a long time to get around to it.
Okay, you've written several times about the experiences of your grandfather in World War
One. That's right.
So one supposes that this is where the first germ of the concept of having your fiction informed by the Great War came from.
Yes and no. I mean, I've always been really intensely curious about the Great War since childhood because of knowing my grandfather, who was shell-shocked, gassed, and he had suffered terrible wounds in his legs at the Battle of the Somme in 1916. And later on, my interest became not academic, but it was quite. I used to read a lot of non-fiction books about the war. So in a way, it comes as no surprise that my fiction thus far has been steeped in that era. But I didn't ever plan to be a fiction writer, you see. That I didn't plan to write Maisie Dobbs. I didn't think, oh, I'm going to write a book, therefore I'd like to write about this era because I'm so interested in it, I just need to think up a plot. I didn't think I would ever write fiction. I was very firmly a non-fiction writer, plus of course I had the day jobs that everyone had. You know, and the reason I was so intent on fiction, I thought non-fiction, was that I thought if I was dealing with fact, I was dealing with what is so. There was a real solidity there. And frankly, I didn't have the confidence that I could make up a story. I mean, being a fiction writer sounded a very romantic thing to be. But in a way that it picked me because, as I've told this story in the past, but the whole idea of Maisie Dobbs came to me literally while I was stuck in traffic. And up to that point, I had never written fiction as an adult. And this image that, and this whole idea that had come to me in traffic was so strong, I went home that night from work and I started to write Maisie Dobbs. And the first chapter has not changed since that time. Then that was my first ever fiction as an adult. You know, my previous fiction started once upon a time, and then even home there, well, happily ever after. And just inside of that, you know, I mean, when I look back to this idea that non-fiction was where it was at for me, I actually think to myself, how naive could you be? Because I have found that I can touch truth more readily with fiction than I could ever with fact, and looking at the distinction between fact and truth, I can touch truth more readily with fiction. For a start, no one's going to sue you, usually. But so I didn't plan to write Maisie Dobbs.
Okay, well, Maisie Dobbs didn't come out of your forehead fully armed like Athena, did she?
She, literally, I was sitting in traffic, stuck in traffic. Long stream of red tail lights ahead of me, and I was actually at a stoplight there. And it was quite early in the morning. I was going to work. I guess it was about 7:15, 7:30. And I thought, I'm a daydream, you know. And I just went off into this little daydream. And I saw as clear as day. It was like watching a movie. This woman came up through Warren Street Tube Station, and I knew it was Warren Street because I used to work in Fitzroy Square, quite near there. But it was not the stainless steel escalator, it was the old wooden clunky clunky clunk escalator. She came through a turnstile and dressed exactly as I described her in the first chapter, came out, had a conversation with a newspaper vendor, walked down Warren Street where she took out an envelope with her keys in it for the new office. And literally this, I knew her name, Maisie Dobbs. It was not, oh, I've got to think up a name for this character, it was Maisie Dobbs. And I mean, literally, I that probably lasted just a couple of minutes. And I suddenly heard all this honking and realised that there's traffic and there's dogs. I'm waiting for a particular shade of green or something, you know. And by the time I got to work, I had the whole story in my head. And I've since referred to that moment as my moment of artistic grace, because, you know, it was like watching a movie in my head. And since then, people have asked me about the name Maisie Dobbs, and I have to say, there was no doubt in my mind that that's what her name should be. I never second guessed it, and I really like it because it has a real groundedness to it. It's every woman, and you know, it's just like of that era. Tommy Atkins was the soldier, every man of the First World War, every man of that era. Maisie Dobbs to me is, she's my every woman.
I guess I can cross that question off the list.
Oh, sorry.
I'm joking. Why is Maisie Dobbs a crime story? How did it? This was just part of the initial inspiration.
It always was going to be a mystery, but of course, you know, I'll be the first one to admit they're very much character-driven stories. They're not plot-driven as such, but as Patricia Paddy would remind me, Elizabeth George always says character is plot is character. Tell me this question again, because I had a thought that went out of my head.
So my question is, how did it become a crime story?
Okay, so it was always going to be a crime story, and as I was writing Maisie Dobbs, so scenes and ideas were coming to me that I knew were part of another story. So I realised I had more stories about this character on, you know, there that could be explored. And I never second guessed it. It was going to be, a mystery. And in a way, I think, you know, when I think of the power of the mystery, as a genre, I always look back to, you know, what a mystery is, and, you know, as an archetypal journey, you know, through chaos to resolution. And I think it's one of the most powerful stories, if you will, that we can write. And so, while some of the, you know, stories have more mystery than others, and I think a mystery is in a way like curry, in that you can have a mild curry or a hot curry, it doesn't make it less of a curry because it's mild. You know, and some of the stories are, you know, mild mystery, and some of them are, you know, a bit more meaty, maybe in terms of the plot. But, you know, that's okay with me.
Okay, so now you've had your moment of grace.
Yeah.
And you have this brilliant idea. And now comes the easiest part, as we all know, putting it to paper. Okay, now, so you've had this brilliant idea. You've never written a novel before.
No, never.
And you know that you have a story that needs to be told.
Yes.
Now what? How did you apply what you know and who you are to actually sitting down and writing that book?
Well, there's a couple of things happen. Number one is I can be very stubborn, and I can be stubborn with myself. And I wanted to write it. The story was coming to me so strongly, it was almost I didn't have a choice. However, you know, there was a point where, I mean, I started writing it in early 2000, and by September of 2000, you know, I mean, it's sort of like the whole thing, you know, lots of things got in the way. I got married, my dog got sick, I moved, you know, just, you name all these things. And I got frightened, actually. I became scared of this whole story that was coming out, because I had not had that experience before. And it became very easy to put it aside. Plus, you know, I was working, and I was doing essentially two jobs. I had my coaching practice, plus I also had a day job, and this writing. And I put it to one side for a while, intending to pick it up in the January of 2001. And it's a really interesting thing, because one of the things I've done in the previous 10 years to concentrate on writing, which, as I said, was mainly non-fiction, was to get a different kind of day job instead of one that was, you know, some big executive position where I was working all the hours God made. I got a different type of position which was really flexible to me. It was I was in sales, you know. Didn't have a 401k. All these things it didn't have. This is all part of my story. Get to January, you know, and here I am, I'm a married woman now. I've got to take life a bit more seriously. And I thought, oh my God, I don't have a 401k. I'm not getting any younger. So January of 2001, I thought, that's it, I'm going to go back, you know, I'm going to get a proper job again. And it was basically fear that did it, and I got myself a proper job. And I was terribly sad about that. You all probably all know the lead time for some jobs, you know, by the time they finished interviewing you is at least 2 months. And I had a great sadness the day that I accepted this job, which had the company card, the 401k, the medical, all the things you want. Because I knew that I was leaving, I was selling myself out. I was leaving behind my books. I knew I would not have time to write my book. I would not have time to write anything. And sure enough, I literally started working at 6 in the morning. I was getting home at 11 at night, and I started work, this job, by the time I started it was early April. And let me think of it, that was it, it was early April. And this is important because it was a big thing that happened in my life then, and I sometimes wonder, would Maisie Dobbs have been finished if this hadn't happened? Maisie Dobbs, I'd written about a third of it at that point, and I had the whole story in my head. I'd been in the job about 3 weeks, and one of my friends called me on Friday night and said, how are you liking that job, Jackie? And I said, I hate it. I said, I absolutely hate it. I've given up my writing. I've given up something I really love. And I would give my right arm not to be doing this job. The next day, I went out, and horseback riding is my other thing. And I had the most horrendous accident and completely smashed up my right arm. And be careful what you wish for. And I could not do that job anymore. I had to go immediately. I had major surgery, immediate disability, and it was just after my surgery, and I was in this kind of structure. And this friend of mine, I was sitting at her kitchen table, and she said to me, 6 months 6 months of physical therapy before you're out of that thing. Now's the time for you to finish that book. And I said, it's my right arm. She said, that's the point there. And she said, you've got a left hand, haven't you? She said, 6 months, what are you going to do? Sit on your butt. And I went home that very day.
Butt, by the way, is British for bum.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So, and that day, I thought, you know what? I cannot come out of this without having something to show for it. And I think it's that sheer bloody-mindedness again. Mm-hmm. I sat down and I got my left hand on the keyboard and I began to write Maisie Dobbs again. And I was so determined to get the other hand on the keyboard. I was religious with all these silly exercises you have to do, like this, walk your fingers up the wall and all that. But 3 months later, I had a finished manuscript and I had both hands on the keyboard. And they told me I would be lucky to get the full use of my right arm again in my life. There, but okay, that's a long story. But I think that's what it took me to do that. It took me this accident, and it was really interesting because so much of Maisie Dobbs was about being wounded in a way, and I think it was. I think I poured a lot of my own situation of being wounded through something, not least my own stupid decision making. Never again will I ever, when that little voice inside, let this be a lesson to you, says, don't do this, don't do it, and be careful what you wish for.
I think it's interesting that you got more serious when you got married, because I know my wife doesn't take me seriously at all. But, all right, so now you have finished the book.
Yes.
Okay.
What happened next?
Well, you see, this is one of the interesting things about your meteoric rise, if I may say so. Maisie Dobbs was originally published by a very small publisher.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm really interested to know what the dynamic or what the events were between the time you finished the book, and presumably found an agent, yes, okay, and sold the book to a small press, to where you are now, you know, a bestseller. It's to me, this is were there some conscious decisions you made in terms of the trajectory that you wanted the series to take with publishers and that sort of thing?
Oh, I didn't know. You're just lucky to get anything, you know?
Okay. So what happens?
Well, basically, I finished the book on August 31st, 2001. I had this in my head. I'm going to finish this book. I set myself a date. And the thing is that, I think this is kind of important. It's important for me. I never saw it as a manuscript. I always saw it as a book, to the extent that every day I printed out my pages, and that was really important for me because it was so physically hard for me to write my pages every day, that I printed them out and I put them in a ring binder. And I even did a little drawing on the front of the ring binder, and believe me, I'm no artist, especially with one hand. And so it was my book. This was my book. And whatever happened, I wanted this book to have something to show for this period in my life. Get to August 31st, I was actually exhausted at that point, having come through this whole accident. My one thing in life that I wanted right then was I wanted to go back and see my parents, because I, you know, it's just kind of a layer thing. I wanted to have time to see my mum. And I didn't have time to even revise the manuscript. I knew there were things that needed to be done, but I kind of didn't know quite how to do them. But I thought, well, I'm going to send it out anyway. And there was something there in me that, having gone through something like that, I was not at all scared of the consequences. I mean, what is a prospective editor going to come and do? Come and break the other arm, you know? But a lot of people are scared at that point of sending something out. I had nothing in the world to lose because I was so broke anyway after all that. So here's what I did. I went to Jeff Herman's book, The Guide to Literary Agents, Editors and Publishers, or Publishers, Literary Agents and Editors, something like that. Which is a great book. I went to the section on literary agents and I read that very carefully. And I picked out 30 agents that I thought would be interested in my book. And I was really profiling because I was looking for agents that were interested in historical, mystery, women's issues, maybe publish something on wars. Those kinds of interests. And then I got my 30, I went back in to that 30 and I got it into my A group, my B group and my C group. And I, you know, thought, right, I'm going to send out the first 10. And so I made up a proposal with my sample pages. I didn't read any of their, well, this is what we want, and this is what... Because I didn't have a time to cater to everyone's different needs. I thought, I'm just going to send them what I got. And so I sent out these things to 10 publishers, which would have landed around about September the 7th, 2001. And, you know, I thought, well, I've done that, we'll just see how it goes. And I was due to fly to England on about September the 20th. And I was out of my... I still was wearing some kind of buckle on anymore. And obviously we know what happened on September the 11th. And I remember thinking, and obviously the last thing you're really concerned about then is your book, you know. But I remember thinking, well, no one's going to want a book on war right now. And the publishing industry is going to go in the tank, you know, because publishing is a very vulnerable industry, as we know. And in fact, everybody in publishing thought that the publishing was going to go in the tank. And so I thought, well, you know, that's it. And, my husband said, well, at least you tried, love. Wait a bit, you never know. Something might happen. And I think I always had something of a belief there, but 2 days before I left for Britain, I had calls from 3 agents who were interested in, and within a month I'd actually had letters from the others saying, we really can't read anything at the moment because we think, you know, the publishing industry is going to be really badly hit by the events of September 11th. And what I did was, I'm saying, what, tweeted me to, well, I'm going to England actually in 2 days, time, so I'll call you when I get back. And that was it, basically, that was the start. And I had I got an agent, signed with an agent by the end of November 2001, and it was sold. Then I made some changes, because I never revised it, and it was sold, I think, by March 2002 to Soho Press. And then it was published in 2003. That was Maisie Dobbs. And it was shortly after Maisie Dobbs came out that they decided that they thought they'd rather like to have another book from me.
And Soho.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think that's probably enough of that story, really. One of the things that my husband said to me, you know, after I got those 3 calls, he said, we have to celebrate every little stepping stone on the way. You know, if you don't get any further than this, you've got this far. And I think that's really important, you know, because it is something to even get an interest from an agent. You know, people don't realize, I mean, there's so many books published. I mean, we all know how many books are published out there and how many books are put forward to agents and editors and so on. And I think, you know, to have had some interest, he says to me, if it doesn't go any further than this, you've got, you know, there's some spark there that you can work on for your next book. And then, of course, when I got an agent, if it doesn't get sold, you've got this far. You're in the game, you know, you've got an agent who's interested in you, and maybe, you know, and then, of course, it was sold, you know. And I still celebrate every little thing, you know, because I think you never know, do you?
How about the move from Soho to Henry Holt? How did that come about?
Well, that came about because, for various reasons, and it was a very, very smooth move. And I hasten to add this, because people always think when you move from one publisher to the other, there's, you know, maybe some ill feeling or whatever. It was an incredibly amicable move. But there were several publishers interested in the character and the series. And generally, it was felt, and even Soho felt this, that to go to the next level, it was probably a good idea to move. And certainly my agent advised me that. But what I wanted to be with a publisher, and I had this in Britain with John Murray, by the way. John Murray published my books in Britain. And they are still a small publisher, but they're within a big group. So you get the small publisher feeling, but you get the marketing whammy of being with a much bigger organisation. And I did not want to be with one of the big publishers where, you know, you phone through and say, I'm Jack and Winston, say, hold on a minute. You know, not because, you know, I need any special attention, but because being with Soho was such a wonderful experience. It's a super publisher. And I had learned a lot from my editor there. I learned a lot about being a writer, being a professional writer. And I really wanted to try and keep on learning. And I felt I could do that better with a publisher that had that kind of energy, that kind of philosophy, if you will. And Henry Holt really matched that. Again, it's like the John Murray profile. It's a smaller publisher, but within the whole Holt Sprint group. So they have the marketing whammy. And yet, You know, I mean, I know everybody there. You know, and they're the same with all their authors. Everybody knows everybody. And so that's very important to me, to be able to grow as a writer, to have that relationship with an editor. And I can still remember the first conversation I ever had with my editor at Soho Press after the deal was done, you know, in my first novel. And, you know, your editor's going to call you. And, oh, gosh, you know, I was terrified. And she got on the phone and said to me, hello, Jackie, oh, it's lovely to be able to talk to you at last. And I said, oh, yes, and I'm so happy and I'm so glad you're going to be publishing my novel. She said, well, now we've got the niceties out of the way, let's see if you've got what it takes to be a professional writer. And then, oh, my God. And I learned so much. And it's really important to keep on learning. But it was a very smooth process.
Okay, let's step back now in time back to Maisie Dodd. So you sold the book.
Yes.
You and the editor have finally reached consensus that this is your final manuscript.
Yep.
You've got a publishing date.
Yep.
And obviously you already know everything there is to know about publicity. Or not.
Well, actually, yeah.
Okay. So how did you go about getting the book into the hands of the readers? How much of that was your work?
I don't know that a lot of it was my work, to tell you the truth. But here's something that I think stood me in good stead. It's really interesting the number of people that picked up on this and assumed that it was easy for me to get my book published because I had worked in publishing. Well, I had worked in academic publishing, which might as well be engineering in terms of the difference between that and publishing as we know and love it. But nevertheless, I had worked for many, many years in sales and marketing within a publishing entity. I therefore had an idea of what that was all about. And because I'd been in sales, I knew someone out there is going to have to sell my book. So I made my business, one of the first things I said to Soho was, can I have the names of all the reps? And they said, no one's ever asked that before. I said, well, it's probably because people don't know you've got them. And they said, well, sure you can. And I wrote a letter to every single rep, because I knew they were out there selling Maisie Dodd. And I said, I just want to thank you for all the hard work you're doing, because I know what your job's like, because I've done it. I didn't say it was college bookstores, but I had an appreciation of that, of what their job was, and I wanted to help them to be able to do their job. So I just said, if there's anything you need, please ask me. If there's anything you want to know, if your booksellers are asking you questions that you can't answer, please feel free to just give me an email. And I think a couple of them did. So that was one thing I did. And even as Soho, they don't have their own dedicated, the smaller publishers don't necessarily have their own dedicated sales force. They possibly have a consortium, in fact they use a consortium type sales force. But they're still out there selling books, and you know, they're picking the ones they're really going to push. And I just wanted, you know, anyone who's been in business knows that you've got to make life easier for the people that are buying your product. and sometimes it's the middle seller that you've got to get to, because I couldn't talk to the reader, so I had to try and communicate with the people in the middle that I could communicate with and make myself available. And I think that's really the main thing I did. You know, I didn't have any, you know, they had an outside publicity firm who I liaised with and said, you know, just anything you need me to do, anything you think I should be doing and I'm not doing, please let me know, because I don't know how you're doing this and I don't know your job, but I do know that it's important for me to make myself available to you. And I think one thing that I would always say to any new writer is this, and that is that, you know, all the time, and this is how I look upon it myself, all the time I'm at home working on my book. That's me. I'm a team of one. That's a purely creative process between sort of me and my book, or me and my characters. And it doesn't go outside of that arena, so to speak. The second I send that manuscript to my publisher, it doesn't belong to me anymore. I mean, it does in the sense that, you know, I'm not going to do anything that I don't want to do. No one's going to say, Jackie, we think you need to do this, and if I don't want to do it, I don't do that. You know, it's my book. But I become part of a team, and that team means that it's important for me to have an understanding of what the salespeople do, what the publicity people do. You know, who's trying to do what for me, and to if it's going to be a success, or it's going to do what they want it to do in the marketplace, and to reach the people they want it to reach. Then I have to make myself available to any ideas that come up. It doesn't mean that I'm going to be a slave to them, but we're a team. Do you know what I mean by that? And I think that's really important to have that attitude.
Did you do a tour for Maisie Doves?
Actually, not a proper tour. What happened there was that Soho did not want to tour me. What I thought was an excellent reason, they said, no one knows you, you're a first-time author, and it can be crushing. You know, I mean, all you're going to get is two people running out from the, talking out in the rain, you know, you don't care about the book, anything, you know, it's raining out there. But then the publicist called me directly and said, Jackie, we've got several booksellers who would love you to go to, you know, be at their bookstores. Now, one of the things that has happened then, you see, I've been on disability for all these months, and I didn't go back to that job, but I did go back to work part-time for another organisation. Plus, we moved from the Bay Area because for various personal reasons. And frankly, I didn't have a lot of money to throw into this kind of thing. You know, I mean, it's not as if I had some great big Stephen King-like advance here. I was able to buy myself a new computer, you know, and that was it. And I said to them, well, you know, I can't really afford to do a big tour. And she said, well, here's four bookstores I think you really would really like you to go there. And I said, okay. And then the bookstores, about four bookstores called me. And each of them said, you know, we'll get you some place to stay if you can do the fare, the airfare. And so I said, fine, let's do that. And so that's one of the things I did. Eventually, I did hire a publicist.
When?
That was really more towards Birds of a Feather. Yeah, after Birds of a Feather. But it was just for a short time, actually. Yeah, quite a short time. And not to do the bookstore sort of things. And that was where I managed to, frankly, strike a deal, because I didn't need a book tour to be set up, because by the time Birds of a Feather came round, Penguin had bought the paperback rights, and Penguin paid for a book tour, a proper book tour, which lasted for months and months and months. And what I thought would be useful, and what I spoke to my agent about this, was to do more book clubs. And so this particular agent, this particular publicist, had a real good relationship with book clubs. And so I started doing a lot of book club and big book clubs, and so a lot of talks at book clubs and so on and so forth, which I think really helped, you know.
Do you have experience in radio, yes?
What do you mean in radio? I've done a couple of radio interviews.
You've done a couple of radio interviews. Didn't you I think I read on your website about appearing on the air in San Francisco. No?
I was on a radio show in San Francisco on KQED. Oh, I published my essays years ago with KQED. They do a perspective series. It's a 2-minute essay. And I had a couple of them that I'd read myself.
I see.
On radio. Nothing big. You know.
So that didn't really figure into your publicity?
No, not at all. No.
Because I know a lot of writers think that the best thing you can do is radio interviews.
Yes.
So it's just...
I've done a few, not as much radio as you might think. And in fact, I think, if anything, the key with Maisie Doves and the fact that so many people ended up picking up truly was word of mouth. And it was the booksellers who really... you know, really, really worked hard with the book. And obviously, you know, it's a trickle-down effect. They had found out about the book, they read the book, they liked it, and they really started hand-selling it. You know, there wasn't a big campaign, there was no big advertising for Maisie Doves. Soho Press is not a big publisher. They only had a very small budget to put into this new book. And they have lots of authors. So it was very much word of mouth, and you know, I was very fortunate with reviews, and also very fortunate. There were a lot of things that were sort of almost serendipitous, in that you know, what's her name, is it in Corrigan? Who is it on NPR?
Fresh Air.
She reviewed Maisie Dobbs on Fresh Air. And I didn't even know it was coming up. No one did. It came out of the blue. I got a phone call saying, can you get NPR? Your book's being talked about right now. I live in Ohio. You can't get anything. You've moved the radio around the room.
So essentially what you're saying is the reason the book got reviewed was because it was a good book. I hate you.
I'm wondering, you know, for all the reasons that I thought the book would never get picked up, I'm wondering whether they are the very same reasons why the book did get picked up. By ordinary, you know, by the readers, I shouldn't say by ordinary people, just by people, because it's about a time of war.
Okay, you and I first met at BoucherCon in Las Vegas.
Oh, you made dreadful experience. I don't mind telling you, I've never been to a writer's convention or anything before. And I nearly never went again. I was so overwhelmed. I was almost crying every day. I was so overwhelmed. Really.
Well, I say she was at a panel about writers who wrote about Britain but did not live there. Mm-hmm. And I remember Carol Adan was on the panel, and my brother Charles Todd and his mother Carolyn, and there was someone else I can't remember, but I saw this beautiful blonde, and I didn't care that I was married and she was married. In particular, she was talking about research,
mm-hmm.
and doing research into 1930s and 1920s London, and the difficulties that you had in getting the geography of London correct.
Right, right.
Which I write 18th century stuff, and I have that same problem. I have to make sure that when I write something that takes place in London, that it was there in 1778,
mm-hmm.
or find out what was there in 1778, and that's actually how we got to be friends.
That's
talking,
right.
Talking
I remember.
About
that. I remember.
Which brings me to the subject of research. lots of times when, and you know, really, Jackie should be interviewing me, but when we talk about historical, and people ask me what makes a historical work, the thing that I always tell them is that you have to hang your hat on something in the period. I write 18th century stories. Every single one of those stories in the 18th century has to turn on something that could only happen in the 18th century. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, what you're doing is writing about people in drag.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no reason to set it in a particular time. And I have to say that the Maisie Dobbs books hang their hat on the late 20s and early 30s. And if you read them, you will be astonished by the fact that you are transported to a different time that is informed by its most recent history. And there's a lot of stuff in there that is particularly germane to the time that you're writing about, which indicates to me that there's a lot of research that you do when you are working on a story. Yes?
There is. But in a way, I sort of suppose I've been preparing for that book all my life because I've always had such an interest in that era. Broadly speaking, from about 1910, before the First World War, right up until, you know, the end of rationing in Britain after the Second World War, 1954. And I've always been, I think it's because it's, I've come to realise what I'm truly interested in is what happens to ordinary people in extraordinary times, and it was an extraordinary time. But for example, I mean, when I was in my mid-20s, a friend and I used to have a stall down Portobello Road in London on Saturdays and Sundays, and it was great fun, and we used to deal in 1920s pottery, china, and jewellery, and so on. So I used to do a lot of reading to be able to sell the stuff that we would, because we had some quite nice pieces that we used to collect and so on. And so even in those kinds of things, you know, fashion in terms of, you know, what you know, the Susie Cooper tea plates or something like that that someone used and so on. You know, I was interested in that as well as the nuts and bolts of, well, what was that year? What was that time all about, in essence? So, in a way, just through my own curiosity, there's information there, almost Trivial Pursuits information or factoids that are there. But then there's the specific research that I do for every single book. And some of that research amounts to maybe, and then there's usually primary and secondary research. There's that which I do myself, pounding the streets of London or reading through archive letters and so on. And then there's the secondary research, which is obviously books and so on and so forth. But I think the key about research is how you use it, because I'm a storyteller. That's my job. That's what I am, that's my role, is as a storyteller. Therefore, every piece of information, fact that I use, that has to support the story. So in a way, research becomes rather like an iceberg, you know, only 7% of it visible above the surface. The rest actually informs every single word. And it's in using certain language, for example, that you can evoke an atmosphere, you know. And I do a lot of listening to audio from that period of time, the old letters and so on, which really gives one a sense of time and place in the language. For example, who begs to inform anyone in a letter anymore? I mean, there was a time that everyone, even if you were writing to your friend, I beg to inform you, I beg to let you know. There was a certain protocol in how you wrote a letter, there were protocols in how you spoke.
My characters all sign their letters. I have the honor to remain, etc.
Yes.
Maisie Dobbs is one of the most carefully dressed characters I've ever read about. And whenever Maisie goes out, there's usually a very clear description of what she's wearing.
Mm-hmm.
One also gets the impression that Maisie, well, certainly the character is an attractive character. One gets the impression, reading about Maisie, that she's generally not very aware of how attractive she is. Is that deliberate on your part, or is that just the way the character came out?
Just the way the character is. Yeah, she's not very aware of how attractive she is. And you know, she's very much one of these people that, you know, she's only got a limited amount of clothes, so she mixes them up a bit, you know, just to make it seem like she's got more than she has.
Yeah. That's one of the things I love about her, frankly, is I like reading about her clothes.
Yeah.
And I'm not gay.
Yeah. One of my friends, when it was after she read Birds of Feather, said, "Oh, I really love the book, and boy, would I like that burgundy suit." And actually, I do draw her clothes. I'm not, and as I said before, I'm no artist, but I design them all myself. And so I have them there. And she's not above, you know, using, I mean, she's got old clothes from other people as well, and she's not above using, you know, when she's down staying with her dad, from climbing into a pair of his old trousers and just putting a big belt around the waist, you know, going for a walk in them. So.
A question that, yes. Oh, I'm sorry. There's one other topic I did ask that we need to cover, and that's because Les and I'd ask a question, and I want to ask a question too, and that is the role of spiritualism.
Right.
Which, of course, is very much a topical, but is of the time
yes.
topic. And also figures prominently in several books. As a matter of fact, in Messenger,
yeah.
She actually is led to a clue by a vision of sorts mm-hmm. when she's mm-hmm. examining the railway car. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know, as I say, this aspect of Maisie's character sort of was one of those things that came fully formed. But in fact, it is supported by history. I mean, on the one hand, as you know, and towards the end of the 1800s in particular, there was this rise of interest in spiritualism, you know, which really sort of went on, and everyone here knows Conan Doyle's stories and so on. But that really was a theme for quite a while. Now, if you then take the whole issue of spirituality, I mean, the number of people said to me, you know, she does yoga. I mean, it wasn't invented in L.A. 20 years ago. And one of the things that was interesting, and remember that Maisie is having some exposure to what we would today call the chattering classes, and also this man that has been her mentor, who's a real, quite a philosopher. He has contacts in all sorts of places. I mean, there's the Khan, for example. Now, one of the things, historically, as you know, Britain, the empire, India was the jewel in the crown, and not only did British culture rub off on India, but a fair bit of Indian culture rubbed off on the British. And certainly in Britain in the early 1900s, I mean, I've got books on yoga that go back to 1910, 1912. I've got a book on Eastern meditation from about 1904. So that was very much part of the broth that this character was exposed to. Along with, in those days, modern psychotherapy has its infancy in the early years of the early 1900s. For example, I think Jung wrote his doctoral thesis in 1904. Maisie at Girton studies the moral sciences curriculum a good deal, and I've got the curriculum from the year that she studied there. A good deal of that curriculum is in the field of psychology, and it's modern psychology as we know it. So I've got a character with this sort of, you know, who's a bit like a sponge, you know, I mean, she's just so desperate to learn, and she's soaking up whatever is thrown to her. Plus, she does have this innate ability. She's one of those people that is highly intuitive, highly, highly intuitive, and I certainly have met people like that, so I'm not going out on a limb by creating that character. And in fact, in the next book in the series, you're going to find out a bit more about where that comes from in her history. So you're actually going to find out a bit more about her background. So that whole part of the character has its roots in very much in history. And as I say, some of the experiments that were going on at that time, and the you know, it's quite fascinating. What we think of as new is really not so new after all. You know, it's the number of people that ask me about, for example, after reading Birds of a Feather, finding out about Pilates, that I mentioned Joseph Pilates. You know, it's all true.
Wasn't he the one who said Jesus? No, that's...
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Joseph Pilates.
You see why I would love nothing to sit here for another 3 hours and talk with this woman? Isn't she wonderful?
Yeah,
let's have a couple quick questions. Yes.
You know, Jim, it's getting a little bit late. I think what we should do is give people a chance to come and buy the books
and ask their questions,
and then ask the questions in an informal situation.
Okay. But before,
Bobby's been wonderful to sit here, but.
The most recent book, Messenger of Truth, Agatha nominee. Those of you going to Malik Domestic, fill in your ballots, please. And please, let us thank the gracious, wonderful, and erudite Jacqueline Winspear for being with us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations, you kidding?